So questions and so forth, I'll just... Yeah, of course.
But what were the things for existing that the infrastructure, the geophysical infrastructure of the internet should become visible to the user at the moment the user or she uses the internet? So this is something which is co-present with using the internet. The second thought would be on the idea of movement. Is movement becoming a metaphorical explain for what you want to describe? Because as long as movement is attached to the body, we are approached toward the continuous process, which are analog processes, so to say. Whereas we get and use this visualization of how internet connections work, they convey geographical state, this logical state, and by using GPS in a personalized way, as you described, it might be that our idea of movement might become not movement moving in space, but moving in sort of logical network. So, which is the very nature of the digital in a way, isn't it? That you jump from one point to another, but there is no continuous tradition, tradition. So the whole idea of movement which is attached to the continuous body movement, and very the opposite from this, the experience of time and space being reorganized in logical ways, which are not time and not space anymore. Will that not produce and change fundamentally our idea of movement itself, so that the very word movement is not such a metaphor for something that will be replaced by a discrete awareness of how we experience the world? So not only the machine is discrete, but our way of perceiving reality will be much more discrete than as opposed to the traditional analog continuous way. And from that moment on, maybe the interfaces themselves might look different.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to say anything about this issue? Since you've
well, done a lot of are you going to say it? I mean, he's asking you.
No, but I mean, I don't. I can say something, but you may also have something to say about this. Or, no.
No, I think.
Well, I'll say something first, and then because I know you've dealt. I mean, you deal with this issue of immersion, and I've had my students read this, so I know you're dealing with these issues as well. I think I'm not so interested in pinpointing one definition of movement. I'm interested in thinking about different ways of conceptualizing movement that may, you know, deal with these phenomenological or ontological questions on the one hand, but also thinking about how we recognize movement as an interface that isn't scanned in the same way as an analog signal, that doesn't have the same kind of physical referent as a realist image would and as the motion picture does. So, I mean, there are these issues, but I'm also, I mean, my interest in this is political. It's about the fact that we have remote sensing and we have a system of global observation that produces knowledges about our movements as moving dots on the planet. And you see this visualized in films like Patriot Games. We're seeing it now in Afghanistan. And so we have to recognize that we are signals, that we are moving data on the one hand, but that we are also perceptual beings on the other. So we can be visualized as a trajectory, as a data set that's ricocheting across the planet or moving in a specific domain. But there are also a bunch of perceptual questions that change as we move from analog to digital media. So I think it's important to ask these questions. I don't have answers yet. I'm really just starting to do this research, and I'm glad to have these kinds of questions. Did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think I was just thinking, for example, of Laura Kirkham's piece on over the GPS thing in Manhattan years ago, where she actually utilizes the inaccuracies that were built in by the U.S. government to prevent, you know, really precise locationing. Because there are certain things reserved for military. But my guess is even the military ones are really not that accurate. So that she was able to say, okay, we have this surveillance system, but it's not perfect. It generates all kinds of artifacts that aren't, you know, really don't match reality. at all. And then there's all those famous stories of using your car and then somebody insisting on following the GPS and driving right into a river or something like that. So we actually don't have a perfect match, and that's kind of interesting too.
Yeah, and the thing to think about also is that this is a part of a commercial imperative. We will move from an e-commerce system to an L-commerce system, which is location-based interfacing that has to do with the next generation of computing with wireless interfaces. So that the FCC just passed regulations that mandated that all cell phone manufacturers embed a GPS chip inside them. And the reason that they did this was because there were some people who were in catastrophic condition, who had a cell phone but couldn't make an outgoing call and therefore couldn't be located and thus died. And there were enough instances of this that happened that the FCC authorized manufacturers to put GPS chips in all cell phones now, which paves the way for also, you know, the delivery of data at the cell phone interface. Many people are probably already checking their email on their cell phones, and you know, and you can use PDAs to check restaurant menus and so forth. But likely there will be also be images distributed as well. So it's really trying to think about the world almost as cells also, that we will be moving through, there will be cellular notions of movement where you move through cells and you'll have to hook up to another node, and then that will allow you to stay globally present, so to speak. And I would argue that these issues are not just digital, that one image that I'll maybe pull up that I didn't show you was the first live satellite broadcast, live global satellite broadcast, 1967, called Our World. And I have a shot inside the studio. And the studio is really imagined as a portal to the world and interpolates the viewer as a signal, as a moving signal, really encourages the viewer to imagine him or herself, not as somebody situated in an armchair in the living room, but as somebody who is moving through a network structure. So I'll pull that clip up while you ask questions. It's not a clip, it's just a still image. So maybe,
I mean, if I can continue that, that's what Disney sees it as, the future of entertainment, and that GPS chip is going to be the holodeck. I mean, that's what's going to make that possible in a sense. Yes, Kate.
I have a question for Rita Bailey. Thank you for the connecting theme and all of your presentations has been the sensor, the nature of the interface in one way or another. And I'd like to thank you for a very rich paper, but return to your conclusion where you're pointing to limitations of the Bengals pros. Mm-hmm. And to say the claim that this is a new sensory and cognitive modality is quite old. It seems to me very different than the sort of claim that Jameson is making. It operates in different ways. And because the claim is old, it doesn't necessarily mean it's valid. So
right.
I would simply say that it does seem to me that it does require a new sensory modality because mm-hmm. it requires homophonic sublocalization, but also visual mm-hmm. apprehension as a non-semantic mark. And visual apprehension and non-semantic marks is constantly pointing, of course, to computer code and raising cognitive awareness of machine-human intelligence interactions. And so I want your comments on
Right. No, I certainly think that's true in a way that it would be true to say that the brain changes every time it absorbs a new piece of information. I mean, in a general sense, this is certainly the case that new sensory modes or abilities are offered or facilitated by these texts. But I do think there's a pronounced similarity between Jameson's setting of the scene in front of the Nam June Paik installation with the multiple video screens and talking about how one cannot absorb all of the images at once in the brain. In a sense, you have to repress all of them in order to allow one singular image to come out. I think there's a distinct similarity between that moment of envisioning a new mode of cognition and the moment in contemporary new media writing. We see the same thing in Lexia Perplexia, I think, when you've got the multiple layers, and in a sense you can only bring out one to the surface, and the others must necessarily be submerged.
But if we say the mark of learning a new language well is that you're seeking to translate into your own language and reading it mm-hmm. directly, what about reading the Bengal?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I can do now. It's certainly true. But in a sense, this is facilitated not just by what she's doing, but by the, again, sheer ubiquity of this kind of language. I see some of her tactics even in contemporary newspapers, like the slipping in of the Z into the word or the slipping in of the period.
Sort of,
kind of like Bert Laden.
Ellen, yeah.
Knowledges about moving bodies and planetary activities that get generated and produced from the orbital gaze. And there's so much movement that is captured and archived invisibly and stored. There's a kind of diachronic omniscience that gets articulated through orbital vision, where we can collect data about activities on the planet through time and then use it retrospectively whenever convenient for those who are in power, for states who need to make a case or to prove something. I think if states, particularly the United States and parts of Western Europe, are using orbital technologies in this way, it's really important that we become smarter about how we move. We become more knowledgeable about our movements, about movement practices that may be more evasive and may, you know, generate kind of hiding places, forms of invisibility that and almost cacophonous movements that disrupt the power of the gaze to produce total knowledge.
And what about technologies that enable us to use the government, such as the Ronald King case?
Absolutely. Well, there's a very interesting initiative called the Public Eye Project, which is a public interest organization that gathers satellite images and then exposes U.S. foreign policy that's often not made public in the press. And they've been very aggressive about doing that and get, you know, different kinds of getting funding from public organizations. So I guess I also think it's important when GPS technologies are being used for so-called surgical strikes around the planet for us to find ways to demilitarize them. Satellites are the most capital-intensive technologies. They're the technologies that taxpayers have subsidized over decades and decades, and yet we hardly know that they exist. We don't know what they do. We don't realize that they're not just for satellite television. They're also for remote sensing, astronomical observation, and global positioning. So there are a bunch of visualizing practices that are articulated via satellite. And I think seeing from that perspective made me think it's important for us to think about the politics of resistance through movements on the ground, since everything can be sort of monitored from this perspective. I don't know if that answers directly.
Good. We have a question in the back here.
I think that there's another moment there, and that's the interpretation of all this data, which
Absolutely.
Is just a huge problem, and leads to it can be used as, the fact that it's data from its source can be used as a means of legitimation when the result would be completely a kind of metaphorical use. I'm thinking, for example, of the Gulf War, where the Saudis were convinced by images of an arrow-like intrusion that, you know, could have been interpreted totally differently. I think Haroun Faraki's pieces on interpretation of aerial data in World War II is an interesting thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the resistance doesn't have to come just by motion, because it has to come at all the levels, including insofar as it's possible in the entire questioning of interpretation.
Yeah, I want to move to in the back there.
Yeah, I just want to point out that the visual group map you pointed out is also interesting in another kind of way, and picking up what Mark said to some degree, this is kind of an image of incredible vulnerability. There's only 19 moves that give the name of absolutely every individual letter of note point. By name and through owners. And so in some way, and as the other one is pointed out, there's a research in Notre Dame, I think, that sort of pointed out that this is a maximum distance that you can travel on a train. So if you can only move for 19 clicks, in terms of movement, this is an extraordinary distance. And so I don't know how one would just gain access to that. It's a pretty small world. And there's one other thing that what is transmittable on that line. I don't know if you know about this. It was the actual embodiment within a virtual, but my father had a bad heart, and so they wired him to a heart monitor, which is sort of like a patron belt, and so they put an electrical note over his heart that monitored him all the time. So if anything that was wrong with his heart, the monitor would pick it up and it would go up a fever, and he would hit that fever and hold it up to a phone. So when he was visiting in San Francisco, his heart rate would be transferred online to
I just wanted to kind of bring it up and make explicit something that's kind of related to what we talked about yesterday with philosophy of information. There's a real tendency for us to slip between the representations of movement or action as information and talking about us as being. The area that I am most familiar with is, for example, genomics, where when you talk to geneticists these days in molecular biology, they're not describing material. You know, they don't think about genetics very much anymore in its material chemical sense. They absolutely think of it as information, not like information, not representing a biological process, information. And I think that one of the things that we kind of get into this to forget is that there are sort of two levels of criticism. And I wonder if anybody would like to comment on that, about the representation of action as information, rather than our persistent tendency to talk about this. Well, just as your example here, talking about the studio as a window and people as actually embodied, encouraging people to think about themselves or their actions as movements.
I think there's a lot of slippage between those two things because of the way that we've been encouraged to imagine movement. I mean, I'm trying to complicate this fantasy of global presence. When what happens here is you've got different monitors that are hooked up, a baby's being born live on television, the first moment that it's possible to unify the world in a moment of time. And what happened was you had 18 countries sending live feeds to the BBC, and then that was going out to 26 countries, to viewers in 26 countries. And so, I think the viewer was encouraged to imagine this studio space as almost a home base, as the center, the circuitry through which we move around the world, as the so-called global village is being produced. And what became completely apparent is, that not everybody was a moving signal. That you saw parts of the globe that were completely dark. And so it brought into bold relief a lot of the disparities and the threshold of the global network, that it wasn't as global as it claimed to be. I don't think I'm addressing your question. I think they are. I mean, we are signals and we are bodies. That's why I'm interested in wireless interfaces. Yeah, I think it's useful to maintain the distinction, but to also recognize the slippage that occurs across them. And I think in my work, I'll try to do that in much more careful material, textual analyses.
Because, in fact, the information study is sort of a central question.
Uh-huh.
What's the nature of information?
Well, a gene is a medium, too. I mean,
well, that's precisely. Except that some people who are working with genes don't even think of it as a medium. They think of it as information,
mm-hmm.
pure information.
That's what's
important.
Yeah, I see.
Mm-hmm. I wrote on that, and what do cyborgs eat? I try to examine that slippage, which is massive.
Yeah.
It's just...
And it's very taken for granted.
Yeah.
It's very hard for us to keep it up. And I think sometimes it's better to make it more present, more explicit, more
yeah.
to be mindful of it anyway. This is one of the ways that, in fact, the empiricism that you're talking about encroaches. Because when the information system begins in a very determined way, to talk about it, but as we begin to adapt behavior, just as you're suggesting, in the business, and think of ourselves as data, as information, then, in fact, we become the product of the machine.
Okay.
And I think that we don't always make that separation mindful.
Yeah, thanks for pointing
Jeff,
out.
Did you have a question?
Well, I just wanted to, I also used a little word in my teaching, and it was sort of interesting to show the bottom of the window, where it actually also draws a map of the route that it's teaching, that it's tracing. Now, it didn't happen in your example, but one of the things that always strikes me is how most of the packet travel to Africa, for example, has to go by way of Europe.
You can go a different, as far as I understand it, you would go different through different routers every time
right.
you went from one place to another, except the beginning and end.
Right. But most of the time when you do that,
I was surprised. I know. I
Africa.
Called somebody and asked if it was a mistake, because I didn't know that there was that underwater cable, going.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like there's a skeleton across the planet of all of these network infrastructures that are.
And it depends on who your provider is, and there's these hidden, what are called peering relationships, between how you get on the backbone. If your provider is a special hidden relationship with the network access provider to get to the on-ramp.
What it suggests is a need for more cultural theorization of distribution. I like the idea of not thinking about production, consumption, and distribution as so distinct as processes, because so many cultural commodities are made for particular distribution systems and outlets. And you could think of the example of in-flight entertainment. A lot of films are cut for seeing them in that context.
I think Jeremy has a question here.
My question was I noticed that in general we focus a lot on information in this session, and I was thinking about the difference between talking about information and talking about knowledge, especially in terms of the users themselves that you're possibly relating these interfaces or these works of are. Is anyone interested in commenting on what kind of knowledge is rather than what kind of information would come out of what it seems like in all of these situations was the user coming to a more clear understanding of their relation to the interface itself, what kind of knowledge would that be?
I think that there is a distinction, and that information is what's there before you actually have it linked up to an interface that can be apprehended through all sorts of sensory, codes. And so I just think there is a big difference. One of the things I was trying to do with the discussion of metaphor is to suggest how this knowledge is part of the interface as well, because the information just can't be, it's not utilizable without this kind of reintegration and re-linking up with a cultural imaginary, I think.
I mean, I just think of knowledge as information that's been mobilized within a system of power. So knowledge, the production of knowledge for me also usually involves issues of power relations. Because information or data can be latent. It can be sitting there until it gets acted upon and put into circulation as language or discourse or...
I mean, in a way, I would say Nightingale is sort of would be positioned in opposition to this because, in a sense, what she's trying to do is thwart habit vis-a-vis information. In other words, I don't remember exactly who said of Gertrude Stein that one never really understands her, one just gets used to her. And in a way, what Nightingale does is in a sense, shift the terms of her game as soon as a kind of habit forms. And as much as there are patterns to her games, the rules will change somewhat. So she's always, in a way, trying to counteract or thwart that habituation to the machine and make you aware of the information as information.
Alan, you had a question?
I was going to suggest that maybe we want to think as well about the mobility and the interaction with knowledge. One of the best questions that we've ever got trying to finish my first book was the opposite flow of your education. Think about it. I use a program called Leo Trace. That was one of these traits with visualizers. Really interesting is that not every fourth month of a process given a server or development is still set up how you wear it in the world and then how you feel or is. So maybe you think that most chapter you might want to include in your book is a chapter on how to hack motion. Slow motion is not in your school, and that's the most expensive. Or, maybe in a whole on the permanent kind of basis. Next up is one word that a lot of us talk about. How do we hack interactivity? Maybe the problem is hack is not to act, not to buy into those fancy kinds of environments. Completely paralyzed. They are some kind of interesting way to make sure the repository is non-circulating. Well, non-circulating, I don't think we call it information anymore. We call it something else. And what that offers.
I had a question over here.
Yeah, I was thinking in all your presentations about concepts of the body. It seems to come back several times, first the body is observed by the GPS, the body is played, or the body is played with the system, standing with light in the environment presentation. And of course, the very fleshy concept of mangle that's built into Ned Mangel. And I was wondering, across all of this, what kinds of conceptions or maybe strategies for bodies come out of an awareness of this observation, this play, between the lived subject, the body, and the system.
Well, one of the things about thinking of the body as a moving dot is that, it's not an anthropomorphic form when you're looking at mass graves in Bosnia from orbit. it looks more like a Mark Rothko painting an abstract expressionist painting, it then gets used as evidence of genocide in the UN War Crimes Tribunal. So I think, you know, the body's comprehensibility is, you know, constantly being reconstituted. And I think it's important to think about, you know, to think about these cyborg discourses, but also sometimes you can't even see the flesh at all. And yet there are very important things happening to the bodies that are imperceptible as we know how to recognize them from other visual regimes. So I guess I'm interested in, you know, in continuing to think about this in relation to movement, these issues of imperceptibility, and anyone else have anything to add? Or?
In a totally different vein, I'm just thinking that about illness and connection with computer use, and you know how much my life has been a struggle with containment, you know, in front of the computer, hours and hours of labor. That to me just leads to you know, really huge problems. So you know, I just would, well, then what about ubiquitous computing? Would we need to actually have this containment? Could it be more spread out? Well, we already to some extent have that, and it makes the whole idea of somehow being able to live a life without computerization and be absolutely still seem rather impossible. So I don't know. I think that that's a huge problem I want to solve in my own life. How can I have a relationship to digital, to the digital world that isn't containing and that isn't actually destructive?
Yeah. Just to throw in the arts for a minute, there is a whole emerging field of dance and new virtual technologies, and a lot is being written about that. And the issues between the body and the virtualizing of it are part of the choreography, in a sense. So it might be, I know you're using it as a metaphor, but it's actually happening as a, as a, as an art form. You might want to look at some of that. In the back?
Yeah, I wanted to get back to the crappiness issue. It's a way of connecting.
Yeah,
we sorry. I wanted to get back to the crappiness issue. It struck me that it's one way of trying to connect today's discussion to yesterday's. When I first heard you say it, I was thinking, oh my God, this is going to be embarrassing. I don't want to know about this person's individual life. But the more I thought about it, it seems as if it's a kind of theme that's developing in the conference, which is when Alan Kay was up there and telling us that, you know, the computer revolution hasn't happened yet, and look at all these great things we did back then, but the great things haven't happened. And even in my own talk at the start, I was saying, here's Engelbart doing all these interesting things back in 62, and they didn't happen. There's an element of craziness to that. Somehow the technology hasn't worked out the way we want it to work out. And sort of two things. One, I mean, we shouldn't be surprised. I mean, Engelbart was being funded by the Air Force. The GPS technology comes out of exactly the same position. And although I sympathize politically with the sense of we should be careful here, or even the sense of some kind of resistance, I'm also getting the sense that there's a real danger in sitting here and being real crabby about it, and that it's not sort of doing other things expecting that it's really our technology and they're trying to take it away from us, but to recognize the fact that it's basically their technology and that it's up to us to sort of do something positive with it instead. So I think there really is an issue of being careful about our tone here as to whether or not it's a sort of hope for future and to do something and to realize something, as opposed to kind of worrying about whether we can parry the kinds of things that this technology was devised to do in the first place.
I acknowledge your critique and would say only that I was wondering, you know, what I would say today, and I somehow wound up with all the fact that I'm still searching for the foundation from which I could rethink my own practice and also think about what's important to me, at least, or to what I think might be important to people in general. So my crabbiness was, I apologize for it, and at the same time, it represents a desire.
It was very useful because you made explicit something that I think is there in the other papers as well, particularly in the GPS paper. I mean, I think that there's a sense somehow that of irritation that people are doing with the technology. And I don't want them to see that. I want them.
Well, yeah, I'm very crabby. I have to admit, I'm really crabby about the military-industrial complex. I guess that is the crabbiness. It's not just in this work. It's probably in all of my work. And so I like the idea of, you know, thinking of ways of demilitarizing machines that may have emanated from those institutions. It's not to say that they couldn't, that they're inherently totalitarian by any means. It means they may have totalitarian tendencies, and that it's up to, as you put it, up to us to figure out productive uses that expand the way we can live and experience the world and know. I guess, you know, maybe I'm a little jilted having looked at satellites just because they seem so forcefully anchored with those institutions. And artists have definitely been using satellite images and using satellites to do live theater, but they sort of got leapfrogged in some of the discussions of the digital. And television too, for that matter. I think there's a sense where, you know, we don't deal with video and television and satellite. And those technologies were being developed and institutionalized at the same time that computers and computer networks were. But TV is like a vast wasteland and it is associated with cultural trash, there's a tendency for us to overlook the very important ways in which it structures a lot of the things that we're talking about as digital culture.
I think
that
maybe we should all move personally and choreograph ourselves into personal discussions and thank the panel.